From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
The Cuban Mafia is running the show in Miami about Elian Gonzalez.
Today, a look at who's behind the protests in Miami. We'll also go to Cardenas, Cuba, where Elian Gonzalez grew up. Then, oily politics. The NAACP, AFL-CIO, and environmental groups are boycotting Crown Oil, alleging racism, sexism, and pollution. We'll look at George W. Bush's connections to the oil giant. Also, Al Gore and Occidental Petroleum. A Colombian court ruled the company can't drill on indigenous lands. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. A number of stories about police brutality today on the front page of the Washington Post. A federal civil jury has ordered Prince George's County and three of its police officers to pay a Temple Hills man $4.1 million, finding that the officers violated the man's civil rights when they beat him so badly he lost his right eye and partial use of his left hand. The verdict for Jimmy McCollum in U.S. District Court in Baltimore, Freddie McCollum in U.S. District Court in Baltimore, was announced early Monday evening, about 4 hours after a jury in a court in Greenbelt, Maryland, found county police violated the civil rights of a Salvadoran immigrant by handcuffing him to a post in the pre-dawn darkness and leaving him there. In that case, the jury awarded the county, a county police officer, and a former police lieutenant, ordered them to pay the man $647,000. The FBI confirmed that it has begun an investigation of a September 9th incident in which an employee of a Kentucky Fried Chicken restaurant in Forestville says he was beaten by two county police officers for no reason. But this is more on the story of Freddie McCollum. The police department did not investigate or discipline any of the officers. McCollum filed a complaint with police but was told he had missed the 90-day deadline. According to testimony during the week-long trial, McCollum went to his nearby house to retrieve his driver's license after being stopped. Police testified that McCollum slammed the door on the officer who had stopped him. That officer then called for backup, and the three officers allegedly stormed into McCollum's house without a warrant, stomped him, beat him about the face and ribs with their batons, and then set the police dog on him. McCollum testified the dog bit his left hand, breaking several bones. And this second story on police brutality in the Washington Post today. In a calm, quiet voice in the middle of the night, Elmer Newman Jr. told the 911 operator that he needed help. Someone was in his Suitland apartment, he said, before abruptly hanging up. Alarmed, the operator radioed police officers and asked them to check out the call. 7 minutes later, four Prince George's County, Maryland police cars arrived in front of Newman's apartment with their lights flashing. Two officers ran up the stairs and banged on his door as one went to the rear of the building. The number of officers said to be involved has changed during the course of the investigation, but the Washington Post writes, what is clear is this. The police shot Newman, who was high on cocaine, in the face with pepper spray, broke two small bones in his neck, fractured two of his ribs, and beat him so severely his eyes filled with blood. This according to an autopsy report obtained by the Washington Post under the Maryland Public Information Act. The officers then put Newman, his wrists and ankles bound by plastic flex cuffs, in a police holding cell until he passed out and had to be rushed to the hospital, where he was pronounced dead about 2 hours after he had called for help. None of the seven officers involved in Newman's arrest and detention will face state criminal charges for their actions, and they remain on the police force. And this news from Jakarta, Indonesia. The U.S. government expressed regret this week over a lawsuit filed against an Indonesian Army Lieutenant General Johnny Lumintang for his alleged role in violence in East Timor last year. U.S. Ambassador Robert Gelbard said his government termed it, quote, an unfortunate circumstance and promised to personally explain to Johnny, quote, the details of the legal action as soon as possible. He said, the U.S. government was not involved with this, and I personally consider him as a friend. Gelbard, the ambassador, said this is very unfortunate. However, the ambassador said his government could not help Lumentang because the case was a civil lawsuit, which, according to the country's court system, bans the government's intervention. The Center for Constitutional Rights in New York and the San Francisco-based Center for Justice and Accountability, on behalf of East Timorese plaintiffs who were killed and maimed, served Johnny Lumentang legal papers when he was in the U.S. last week at the U.S. government's invitation to speak in a seminar about reform movement within the Indonesian military. Johnny Lumentang was charged with crimes against humanity. This news from Baghdad. An authoritative Iraqi newspaper said today that the new UN humanitarian coordinator in Iraq could not improve the oil for food program linked to a UN sanctions regime and might as well resign.
Traigo un cantar hecho de palma y de sol, cantar de la vida nueva y del trabajo creado.
Traigo un cantar de Cuba traigo un cantar.
Cuba traigo un cantar para el ensueño mejor, cantar para la esperanza, para la luz y el amor.
You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Cuba yesterday ruled out an immediate trip to the United States for Elian Gonzalez's father, saying the 6 travel visas granted by Washington did not meet either of his proposals for taking charge of the boy. The senior U.S. diplomat in Cuba, Vicky Huddleston, personally handed over 6 stamp passports for Elian's father, stepmother, baby half-brother, and young cousin, as well as for a kindergarten teacher and a pediatrician. But Havana said the father, Juan Miguel Gonzalez, is still insisting on one of 2 alternatives, that he go alone to pick up 6-year-old Elian and bring him back immediately, or that he lead a 28-member delegation to look after the boy in Washington while the legal battle finishes. Meanwhile, in Miami, scores of anti-Castro demonstrators surged through a police barricade yesterday to form a human chain around Elian Gonzalez's house, vowing to resist any federal attempt to remove the boy. Miami police stood by and watched. The crowd grew edgy during the hot day as they learned that a visa had been granted to Elian's father so he could come to the U.S. to be reunited with his son. We are joined on the telephone right now by Francisco Ruca, who is a Miami radio talk show host from Radio Progreso. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Well, thank you. Thank you for inviting me. It's a pleasure being here.
Well, can you tell us about the scene in Miami right now?
Well, as you described it, it's edgy. What we saw on TV yesterday is exactly what has happened before and could happen again in the future, and that is about 100. I have heard figures from anywhere from 60 to 100 Cubans who are keeping a vigil daily in front of the house. At one moment, somebody said that an immigration boss was coming by to pick up Elian, and that led the crowd to break the police barrier and dash to the house and form a human chain in front of the house. If nothing else, as you probably realize, and your audience may realize, this is nothing new. That house has been sort of under siege for a few months now. When the grandmothers of Elian visited the States over a month ago, the relatives here insisted that that should be the place to meet, and that was one of the reasons why the grandmothers did not want to go there, saying that is not a safe place at all, which it isn't. So what we have here is a number of Cubans who, in our experience, is much less than it used to be. That is, most of the Cuban community is not participating in this. And if nothing else, is showing a decrease in the ability and capability of these exiled forces to mobilize people onto the streets. A few years ago, this would have been thousands of people in there, and now there are only dozens. But basically, what you have is a group of people that are politically motivated and politically manipulated, by the leaders of this exile community. And basically, they're there, if nothing else, providing a bargaining chip for the forces that want to keep Eliang here. Our government has not been able to convince the relatives' lawyers to come to a procedure by which that boy will be transferred to his father if his father arrives. And one of the reasons why the government is being very patient is because the government, I feel, is afraid of what the consequences may be in Miami, particularly in an electoral year. So consequently, what you saw on TV, that unrest, that illegality, words such as the words expressed by Mayor Penelas, that the police would not interfere.
He's the Miami mayor.
Yes, well, he is the mayor of Dade County, but the Miami mayor made similar statements. What contributes here is to your realization, and I say your realization as people from outside Miami are finally realizing what has been going on for 40 years. It's just that this is an instance, because of the attention that this case has created, that now all Americans are realizing that what is happening in Miami, and has been happening in Miami for, as I say, close to 40 years, are very un-American type of activities. There is an industry, as I call it, a very powerful group here, that is making a lot of money behind a political thesis. They own big businesses. They elect politicians. Through the politicians, they get contracts. And these people have a tremendous amount of influence. They make great contributions at election time. They have a tremendous influence on the media. So all this has existed for 40 years.
Francis,
and whenever somebody was going to get out of line, social pressures will be provided, or if need be, violence such as the one you saw on TV yesterday, or at least possible violence as breaking through the police barricade. In a way, what is happening is that Eliang's case is making it very clear to the rest of American public opinion what the conditions are in Miami. Are conditions that are not very conducive to diversity of opinion or disagreeing with those powerful forces.
Francisco Rucco, you are one of the few public Cuban-American voices to be speaking out against what you're seeing outside of Elian Gonzalez's distant relative's house. Your voice on Radio Progreso, what kind of response have you gotten?
Oh, the Radio Progreso success, all I can tell you is it's been huge. We have been on the air since 1995, and it has been a tremendous success for two reasons. One, we are providing information that the media, particularly the media in Spanish, does not provide. Because, again, as I said before, information is curtailed here. Secondly, on the basis of information that is not provided, we also provide with a different perspective, a different opinion, something that is very recent in Miami, that was not taking place in Miami. Consequently, in Miami, Cubans and non-Cubans alike would like to have, of course, a better level of information and be and have available different perspectives that everybody likes. So consequently, the program is enjoying a huge success. I would say 50% of the calls I get in my daily program from the public, and I talk to the public every day. I open my lines after I make my analysis of the different topics we have covered. I would say easily close to 50% are people who disagree with me. And sometimes they disagree with me very vehemently. And my answer, of course, is, well, if you're listening to this program, it's obvious that you're finding something of value. What they're finding of value is exactly what has been missing in Miami. Enough information and different opinions. So, as I said before, Eliang's case is making now other Americans realize that this city, under the tremendous control and influence of that industry, I call it an evil industry, because it's really having evil results, in Miami and on the Cuban people with all this stress on isolation and so forth. But anyway, at least the rest of the American public opinion is getting a crash course on what Miami is at a moment where they are paying attention.
Francisco,
let me just make this final point. Notice that how important it is their power, that for now almost 10 days, the INS lawyers have been negotiating with the lawyers that represent the Miami relatives. And believe me, the Miami relatives are nothing except that they are backed by this powerful industry. And our own government has not managed to get them to agree as to what would be the procedure to transfer that child to the father's hands if that father arrives here. They have not been able to agree to that. It's important that you keep this in mind. It is true, as is being reported, the father is saying, I would go even to Miami by myself and pick up my child and come back if it is to come back to Cuba. If I'm going to stay there for a few months, they want other people to come, particularly classmates, to provide a better environment, according to their opinion. But the important thing that shouldn't be lost in this argument is the fact that the main reason why that father has not managed to come yet, and the lawyer now, his lawyer is in Cuba trying to come to an agreement, is that the government promised to give them an answer as to how that transfer is going to be made. Everybody knows that he should take custody of the child when he lands here because that is the law, and that law was recognized by the federal judge. But our own government has not managed to get that agreement out of those people. That is a sign of the tremendous level of power and influence they have in South Florida.
Francisco Ruca, Miami talk show host at Radio Progreso. We're also joined in the studio by Jane Franklin, who is author of Cuba and the United States, A Chronological History. We're seeing a lot of pictures of what's happening in Miami, Jane Franklin, but we don't know who the people are who are there and behind the scenes behind these protests. Can you give us a lay of the land?
Well, as Francisco Aruca was just saying, this goes back at least 40 years. And Amy, I'd like to begin with exactly when the connection with what is called by Cuba the Cuban Mafia, and I think it's an apt description, when that began in August of 1960 during the Eisenhower administration. And in my book, I say the CIA takes steps to recruit members of organized crime for help in assassinating Prime Minister Castro. Now, we did not learn of this until 15 years later when the Senate Select Committee on Assassinations began an investigation of what the CIA had been up to in Cuba and around the world as far as assassinations went. And there were many, not just attempts, not just in Cuba, and many successful assassinations. According to testimony by Colonel Sheffield Edwards on May 30, 1975, to the Senate Select Intelligence Committee on Assassinations, Richard Mervyn Bissell, Jr., former Yale professor turned CIA chief of covert operations, asked Edwards, director of the CIA's Office of Security, to locate someone who could assassinate Castro. Bissell confirms this in his own 1975 testimony. Edwards decides to rely on Robert Mayhew, a top aide to Howard Hughes and a former FBI agent. Well, then Mayhew recruits underworld figure John Rosselli. Rosselli recruits Chicago crime boss Momo Salvatore Sam Giancana, whom we heard a lot about in relation to Kennedy later. Rosselli also recruits Santo Trafficante Jr., who, according to his own testimony to the House Select Committee on Assassinations in 1978, introduces Mayhew, and here's the important thing, introduces Mayhew, Giancana, and Rosselli to some, quote, very active, unquote, Cubans in Florida. Now, those very active Cubans in Florida remain active Cubans in Florida, and they included people like Jose Basulto, who's one of the main organizers of these street demonstrations outside Elian Gonzalez's house right now, and they included people like Jorge Mas Canosa, who was a founding member of the Cuban American National Foundation, the main backer of what Aruca was just calling the industry of the evil industry in Miami and in the Cuban American community, also in New Jersey. Now, if we skip forward a bit to 1970s, when the Watergate scandal broke out, listen to this, and this is one of, see, I believe that one of the main reasons that these Cubans in Miami right now have so much influence is that they know a lot. And that came out during the assassination trial in 1997. They threatened to expose what they knew if the United States really prosecuted the attempted assassins of Fidel Castro.
What assassination trial?
The one where Fidel Castro was going to Margarita Island in Venezuela for an Ibero-American summit meeting, and people were accused of being on their way to assassinate him when they were arrested off the coast of Puerto Rico. They were acquitted in a trial in Puerto Rico last year, but the main evidence was not presented. The main confession that one of them made was not permitted in the trial. And so they did not have their full case and were therefore acquitted easily. Now,
I'm going to interrupt you because we have to break for stations to identify themselves. But you're hearing a description and background to the a portion of the Miami Cuban community, from Jane Franklin, who is the author of Cuba and the United States, A Chronological History. On the line with us from Miami is Francisco Ruca, Miami radio host at Radio Progreso. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! When we come back, we'll be rejoined by them. And then Maria Carrion, senior producer at Democracy Now!, will take us to Cardenas, Cuba, to hear the sounds of the community where Elian Gonzalez grew up. Stay with us. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. As we continue with a journey through the Cuban-American community of Miami, not monolithic, as we've heard from Francisco Ruca, who is a Cuban-American living in Miami, at radio talk show host at Radio Progreso, and Jane Franklin, who is a Cuba historian, and she's author of the book Cuba and the United States, A Chronological History, as you continue with this history.
Well, as I was saying, this connection goes back at least 40 years, as Aruka was also saying. And these people have worked so closely with the highest echelons of our government for these four decades now, including very closely with covert operations in the Central Intelligence Agency. And during the Watergate investigation, a very interesting conversation took place with Nixon and Haldeman. Trying to cover up the involvement in the Watergate burglary, President Nixon has a conversation with his aide, H.R. Haldeman, about how to stop the FBI's investigation from reaching the White House. Nixon conspires with Haldeman to threaten exposure of the activities of E. Howard Hunt, who is a CIA agent, and his team of Cuban exiles, in order to get CIA Deputy Director Vernon Walters to call FBI Director Patrick Gray and tell him, stay to hell out of this. Nixon reminds Haldeman, this all came out, by the way, on the tapes that were found later. Nixon reminds Haldeman that we protected CIA Director Richard Helms from one hell of a lot of things, that's all in quotes. Speaking of Hunt, Nixon says, quote, you opened that scab, there's a hell of a lot of things. This involves these Cubans, Hunt, and a lot of hanky-panky that we have nothing to do with ourselves. He instructs Haldeman to tell Walters that, quote, the president believes that the investigation is going to open the whole Bay of Pigs thing up again. And, of course, that relates to the assassination of John F. Kennedy, because many people suspected Cuban involvement in that because of John F. Kennedy's refusal to provide air cover. Now, this kind of connection between the CIA and the White House continued to a very important point in 1981, right after the inauguration of President Ronald Reagan. Then
the connection between CIA and the White House?
Yes. Because Richard Allen, the first national security advisor to President Reagan, provided the impetus for founding the Cuban-American National Foundation. Reagan and Allen and other people in the White House decided they needed a lobbying arm for their Cuban policy. They wanted an outfit that would carry out their policy. They founded the Cuban American National Foundation. It was not a grassroots organization. One of the first people they named to it, one of the three first founders, was Jorge Mascanosa. He's the only one that stuck with it because the other two did not want to carry out such puppetry. In other words, they felt they were being used.
I just want to interrupt for a minute because I know Francisco Ruca has to go off to his own radio show in a few minutes. As you hear this description, I also want to say we did invite Camp Fon, the Cuban American National Foundation, but they did not return our calls. This history that we have, how does that play out today?
Well, let me tell you, obviously I was listening to Jane Franklin's presentation, which everything she's saying is true. But what I was thinking is, and if you allow me to do it in the next 2 or 3 minutes, because it's true, I need to get off, what is important that people realize is that these people were created under a mantle of impunity, supposedly justified by national security. First, because of our policy to Cuba in the early 60s, and later on because of the Nicaragua situation, which is what she also brought up. But important thing is to realize that these people were protected by federal institutions, under the excuse of national security, and from the very beginning, they enjoyed a tremendous level of impunity. They would do almost anything they wanted to do, and they would be outside of the law, but nobody would do anything about it. They became, based on that same connection, they became very well entrenched and established business people. Most of the people that Jane has mentioned are now very prosperous businessmen or created very prosperous companies. Jorge Mascanosa died. His three sons that he has, preside over an almost now billion-dollar operation in South Florida. And that is just one of the business operations. That is why I refer to them as an evil industry. That is, that same impunity that they enjoyed due to national security considerations, now they enjoy because of the tremendous influence of their money that they managed to make under that protection. So now it's an operation that really doesn't need the CIA. As a matter of fact, sometimes I think that they are doing whatever they want, even if the CIA wanted them to do something different, although I cannot prove it. The fact is that through the money, they have elected politicians, money that they acquired precisely in that process that Jane Franklin described. They have elected politicians. They control a lot of the media, particularly in Spanish, and they have cowered some of the media in English, such as the Miami Herald, who I could give you the proof that they are afraid of fighting these people down here.
What's the
and
proof?
Now they enjoy impunity again, and at least to a large degree, very few voices have access to the media here, such as my radio program. Now impunity that is being achieved not because of national security. As a matter of fact, they are acting against U.S. national security, as far as I am concerned. They are enjoying it because of the tremendous amount of money that allows them to have the tremendous influence they have down here.
What is the proof of the Miami Herald be kowtowing to them?
First of all, there was a campaign, it was a public campaign, by the way, by Mascanosa against the Herald and Dave Lawrence, that everybody here realized that whenever Dave Lawrence was going to answer what Mascanosa was accusing them of, he would basically just act like a little boy. I mean, didn't
Dave
want to
Lawrence
offend the
was
guy.
A publisher?
I'm sorry? He was the former publisher, correct. Mm-hmm. And I have a box full of articles, by the way, that appear in English and do not appear in Spanish because they have a policy of not offending these extreme right-wing forces in Miami, and therefore sometimes they go ahead and publish something in English, but it does not appear in Spanish. And I have bundles of articles in relation to that. This is a very well-established fact. What is important is that now, slowly, American public opinion is learning about it. And that is maybe one of the good things that is coming out of this tragedy that is Elian's case. And I use the phrase, God writes straight with crooked words. And out of this tragedy, maybe some good is coming out. American public opinion is becoming more and more aware of how un-American these activities have turned out to be in Miami.
Francisco Ruca, I want to thank you for being with us, Cuban-American Miami radio talk show host with Radio Progreso, who is going off now to do his own program, as we caught him between two of his shows. And we remain with Jane Franklin. In just a minute, we're going to go to Maria Carrion in Cardenas, Cuba, to hear from the people of Elian's town. But Jane Franklin, you talk about the Cuban mafia, which is a very pejorative term. But let's talk about the mafia connections to Batista, who Fidel Castro overthrew. The people may not realize Batista came to power twice. And the second time, talk about his connections with the mafia. What was this, 1952?
Yes, well, he overthrew the elected government in Cuba in 1952, suspended the constitution and canceled the elections, and immediately established a dictatorship that lasted until the revolutionaries were able to overthrow it. And it was precisely people like Jorge Mascanoza, and the people that he works with, like José Basulta, it was precisely that kind of person in charge in Cuba that caused the revolution that overthrew Batista. Many of these people were directly working for Batista. Many of these people who are in the streets right now were part of the Batista machine. Some were not. Some supposedly were on the side of the revolution but turned against it when it started nationalizing private property, which any revolution, given its worth, has to do. But I would like to get to one thing about the connection right now. I Arouca covered so much territory there and very well. And I'd like to point out that we should never forget there's part of Washington that is very much in favor of what these Cubans are doing with Elian Gonzalez. There is Senator Helms, there's Senator Sully, there's Tom Lay, DeLay, who has an op-ed piece in the Wall Street Journal this morning that puts it very clearly. He says the battle of Elian Gonzalez is about competing values. And he maintains, of course, that no child is better off living in a communist country than in this country, no matter what the situation, and forget the father. That is his position, and that is the position of the right wing in this country. And unfortunately, Gore, Vice President Gore, in his campaign for president, has joined his voice to those. And I'm afraid that it's not just opportunism on his part. I'm afraid that he means it.
Well, Al Gore has gotten more than $300,000 from the Cuban-American community in Miami, as Bill Clinton did before in his time of trouble at the time when he was first running for president. Jennifer Flowers' scandal was in the news, and the money stopped coming in for Clinton. He did get a lot of money from the Miami Cubans. But you say the right wing in the United States is supporting this position. There are actually many conservatives who are not, who are saying that family values does trump ideology. But again, I wanted to go to, for example, José Basulto, who is outside of Elian's house. What are the crimes he has been involved with?
Well, first of all, he pretended in Cuba, in Santiago de Cuba in 1960, that he was a student. And he was actually part of the fifth column that the CIA was inserting into Cuba at that time to prepare for the Bay of Pigs invasion in April of 1961. He escaped being killed in that invasion. All the members of his team escaped with him. José Basulto continued working with the CIA, as did Jorge Mascanoza, who was also part of that invasion attempt. And José Basulto formed in 1991, you would think, you know, that once the Soviet Union fell apart, that the United States policy would have been to help Cuba maintain the best education and healthcare systems in the Third World at that time. But the United States instead concentrated on renewing terrorism, and the terrorism has kept escalating all this decade of the 90s. And José Basulto in 1991 formed this euphemistically named Brothers to the Rescue, which he said was looking for rafters, which was really very often flying illegally over Cuban territory, leafleting Havana, even from Guantanamo Naval Base, which is controlled by the United States, of course, on Cuban territory. He would fly out of there with leaflets over Havana. And yet when he was questioned, he would say, well, he's just looking for rafters. And, of course, that ended in the notorious incident where he himself and his plane had definitely violated Cuban airspace. He was with two other planes which may or may not have actually gone into Cuban airspace, but were shot down by Cuban planes trying to stop that kind of activity. And that led to the passage the next within 2 weeks of the Helms-Burton bill, which is the most severe part of the trade embargo that now exists against Cuba, which is aimed at starving Cubans into submission. Talk about caring about Elian. They care about him now that he's in Miami. But while he was in Cuba for the first almost 6 years of his life, this policy was aimed at starving him to death. So Jose Basulto got away that time, too. All the other planes, the two other planes, were shot down. He escaped. And so he's a master at escaping blame and escaping being a target of Cuban resistance to this kind of terrorism.
I want to break now to bring in Maria Carrion, senior producer of Democracy Now! You've been listening to Jane Franklin. She's the author of Cuba and the United States, A Chronological History, and we may have time to come back to you. But we've actually pushed some of the programming that we were going to do today, Oily Politics, looking at George W. Bush's connections to Crown Oil and the boycott that the NAACP and the AFL-CIO have of Crown Oil, as well as Gore and Occidental Petroleum and the latest of Occidental Petroleum drilling in Colombia. We are going to put that off to tomorrow's show so that we can hear the sounds of the community where Elian Gonzalez comes from, and that is Cardenas, Cuba. And Maria Carrion has just returned from there, and it's great to have you back, Maria.
Thank you very much. It's great to be with you, Amy. Well, as you just said, this past Friday, just a few days after a U.S. federal judge ruled that Elian Gonzalez should be returned to his father in Cuba, I had the opportunity to travel to the town of Cárdenas, where Elian is from. Located in the province of Matanzas, about 100 miles east of Havana and just a few miles from the tourist mecca of Varadero, Cárdenas is a sleepy town where horse-drawn carts, Chinese bicycles, and 1950s American cars are the main form of transportation. Its central attraction is a round domed marketplace in the town's main square, which is surrounded by a coffee shop, a fast food restaurant, and a barber shop. The city was founded in 1828, and much of the early population was comprised of refugees who fled Haiti following the revolution. It developed as a prosperous sugar-producing town. In 1850, it tried to liberate itself from Spanish rule, becoming the first town to fly the Cuban flag in all of Cuba. It has since proudly called itself the Flag City. Cárdenas today lives from several processing plants and an offshore oil rig. Some of its population commutes to Varadero to work in much-coveted tourist jobs, which pay in dollars. Aside from the produce and meat markets selling food in Cuban pesos, Cárdenas now also has several dollar stores, which Cubans refer to as choppings. I arrived early in the morning and headed for the town square. Cárdenas was in full swing, horse-drawn buggies carrying people to their jobs and hauling produce, and the market's loudspeakers announcing the day's prices. I expected to encounter a journalist or two at the very least. Instead, I seemed to be the only person from out of town, and people gazed at me with intense curiosity. My first stop was at the Barbería, the town barbershop, a huge place that seemed to be a main gathering spot for the men of Cárdenas. I approached a barber who was trimming a young boy's hair, and I spoke with both.
¿Cómo se llama esta barbería?
Barbería La Nueva.
This is Barbería La
Nueva.
La
Nueva. ¿Y usted cómo se llama?
Rigoberto González.
¿Y qué le parece todo lo que está pasando ahora en Miami?
Bueno, normalmente ya todo el mundo sabe, se conoce lo del problema de Elian y...
Well, everyone here knows about the injustices committed against Elian by the anti-Cuban mafia in the United States. There is no other solution but to bring the child to Cuba so he can be here with his father in his country. The people of Miami must see that they have lost the fight, that there's nothing else they can do. Now it looks like the family is getting ready to go to the United States. If necessary. Yes, the family and a delegation of doctors and other people who are getting ready, if necessary, to go help him. Do you know the family? I've seen them around. They're a humble, hard-working family, very honest. The grandmother lives right here, next door to the barbershop. She's a hard-working and honest woman. Do people talk a lot about this? Yes, on the radio, on TV, and imagine. He's from here, he's from Cárdenas.
Manifiesta mucho y se habla mucho sobre el caso de Elian. Es una cosa que ya está escrita, que tiene que regresar.
Maria Carrion translating for the people that she interviewed when she was in Cardenas, Cuba. And we're going to go back to the streets of Cardenas, where Elian grew up, in just a minute. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Stay with us. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman with Democracy Now! Senior Producer Maria Carrion, who's just returned from Cardenas, Cuba, where Elian Gonzalez's family lives. She was there just a day after the family left for Havana as they are trying to negotiate the visa process to come to the United States. Maria, you're in the midst of interviewing. Is it the barber?
It's one of the town barbers on the main square. And I listeners heard, he was just talking about what Cardenas, people in Cardenas are saying. So I take on just asking him, if Elian needed a barber to cut his hair, would he go to the United States?
Y si Elian necesitara cortarse el pelo de vez en cuando y un barbero, ¿usted se iría?
He says, of course. I would go in a minute. He said, of course, if they asked me to go on the delegation, I would go. Then I turned to the child who's having his haircut, Edwin.
Como niño.
He said he should come here. He said what they're doing to him is unjust. He's just a little kid. He should be with his dad. Next, I walked two doorways down to the town pharmacy, after being told that Elian's family lived just above it. On the family's door was a sign that read, "Return little Elian to his school desk." The pharmacy was lined with wooden shelves stocked with medicines, including a section of green or natural medicine, now increasingly popular in Cuba. I headed for a group of women who were chatting in the corner of the shop and asked them about their feelings regarding Elian's case. They say they should bring him here. That's what they should do, because he's ours. Elian is here, from here, from Cardenas. They're from here, I asked them. They said that, yes, they live right here. The family lives right over us. And they say all the compañeras in the family know him. They say he should be sent back to his father. His father cannot sleep, cannot live without him. What's the response here in Cardenas, I ask? Everyone here is desperate, they say. We all want him to come back. What on earth would they do with this child there? One woman says, I lost hearing one ear. I became ill when my blood sugar shot up because I was so upset. And we will only be happy when he returns, they say. And people will be very happy when he returns. The most sincere caress is always from the father. As long as he's alive, he must be the one to caress him. Several men approached and also gave their comments.
¿Qué le parece el tema de
Elian? Bueno, yo vivo cerquita, a todos lados donde vive Elian ahí. que pronto va a estar aquí en Cuba. Y Juan Miguel es mi amigo.
I live right by Elian, and Juan Miguel, his father, is my friend since a child.
Bueno,
where is the family,
no,
I
no,
ask?
Están en La Habana, porque los preparativos para...
I haven't seen them for days, he says. They must be getting ready for Elian's return.
¿Cuál ha sido la respuesta aquí en Cárdenas desde que ocurrió esto? ¿Cómo ha respondido?
And what has been the response here in Cárdenas?
Bueno, el pueblo de Cárdenas, bueno, Elian es natural de Cárdenas. Imagínate,
well, imagine, he says. People are indignant, and they're asking for Elian. He's from here.
¿Qué está pasando ahora en Miami? El alcalde de Miami se niega a entregar al niño. El gobernador.
What do you think about what's going on in Miami? I ask, where the mayor and the governor are refusing to cooperate to return the child, and it's all in chaos.
Es una cosa absurda. Si ya la eliminación, ¿no?
It's absurd, he says. A judge already ruled that Elian should be returned. He should have been here a long time ago.
¿Y por qué cree usted que está pasando esto en Estados Unidos?
And why do you think, I ask, that he has not been returned so far?
No es Estados Unidos. No,
it's not really the U.S. It's a small group of people who think that the kings of Miami and want to dominate the U.S. government. But the judge said the last word. He should be returned, he says.
Que Elian tiene que estar aquí en Cuba.
¿Y usted qué cree que va a pasar?
And I ask him, do you think
sí.
He'll be returned?
Que regresa a Cuba.
He says yes.
Que regresa a Cuba.
He'll come to Cuba.
Confío, no se puede.
We cannot beat, no one can beat
bueno,
Fidel.
Elian,
no one can beat Cuba.
Él, hay que trabajar con él, porque le han hecho
and when he returns, we'll have to help him, because they have hurt him tremendously. Another man approaches also to speak his mind.
¿Cómo se llama usted?
Lorenzo de Armas.
My name is Lorenzo de Armas,
que es una injusticia.
I think it's an absolute injustice.
Cobardía de los americanos.
A cowardice on the part of Americans.
Tiene que estar en Cuba.
Elian is Cuban, it should be here.
¿Y de los cubanos de Miami, qué tiene que ver todo esto?
What do you think of the Miami Cubans? Those people are not Cuban.
Fueron cubanos.
They used to be Cuban, but their behavior is not Cuban.
Como actúan ellos, no son cubanos.
Y para los oyentes que no conocen Cárdenas, no saben lo que es.
I ask him, for people who've never been to Cárdenas, how would you describe your community?
Como una comunidad acogedora.
He says it's a warm community.
Revolucionario.
And revolutionary.
Por primera vez ondeó la bandera cubana aquí.
The Cuban flag flew here first. Cárdenas will always be revolutionary. Then another woman approaches.
Yo soy madre, tengo
39
años.
I'm a mother, she says.
Tengo una hija de 16.
I have a 16-year-old daughter.
Niño tiene que venir para
that
Cuba.
Child must be returned
ese
to Cuba.
Niño no lo pueden retener más tiempo
they
allá,
cannot keep
favor,
him any longer,
lo traigan
please.
Para Cuba porque mi mamá de 73
because my 73-year-old mother is suffering and praying that he will return.
Ese niño que lo acaben, que deciden ya que ese niño tiene que estar aquí en Cuba.
¿Por qué cree usted que Elian se ha
convertido en tal
símbolo?
I ask her why she thinks that Elian is such a symbol in Cuba and why she's so, he's so close to their hearts.
Nosotros los cubanos somos así. Ese niño se nació aquí en Cárdenas.
She says, Cubans are like this. He was born in Cárdenas.
Por ser así. Además, ese niño es,
but also, that child is not so much a hero or a symbol. He's just a kid who's from Cárdenas.
Nosotros los cubanos nos caracterizamos por eso.
Y para la gente que no conoce Cárdenas, que no se imagina lo que es estas, ¿cómo describiría usted Cárdenas y su comunidad?
I ask her how she described Cárdenas. She says it's a beautiful place.
Histórico, el museo.
It's historical. Parks, churches, museum.
Tiene los parques. No, aquí en Cárdenas hay industria. Está la
there are industries such as the factory.
Está aquí es la antigua Rechavala. Aquí está la fábrica de conservas. Aquí en Cárdenas,
everyone
todo el mundo
here in Cárdenas
trabaja.
Works.
Aquí no se pasa hambre.
No one goes
aquí
hungry. Everyone is able to dress.
Aquí tú no ves ningún niño pidiendo una limosna.
You won't see any children begging or sleeping on the streets.
Aquí todos nos ayudamos.
Everyone helps one another here.
Esa es mi opinión. Yo muy
that's
contenta de ser cardenense, de ser cubana.
And I'm very happy to be cardenense and proud to be a Cuban. She shows me the plaza. She shows me the rápido. I ask her what it is. It's a shop that sells in dollars, she says. And there's a market square where they sell everything. It's a monumental historical museum. It sells vegetables and meat. So here in Cárdenas, we don't go hungry. I crossed over to the fast food restaurant where several people were also buying and selling clothes and toys. I stopped a woman and her daughter and also asked them about Elian's case.
¿Cómo te llamas?
What's your name?
Heidi, ¿cuántos
Heidi.
Años tienes?
12. I'm 14 years old.
No, bueno. ¿Y qué
she
te
says she's in the ninth grade.
Está pasando ahora con Elian
and I ask
en
her about
Unidos.
Elian.
Bueno, que es una injusticia lo que están haciendo porque ese niño nada más que tiene 6 años, no
She says it's an injustice what they're doing to Elian. He's only 6 years old and doesn't know what's happening to him. I asked her what children are saying. She said children are saying that Elian should come back. She also says that in schools they have open trials where people are expressing their opinions and demand Elian's return. I turn to the mother and I ask her what she thinks. She says, imagine what I think. Manola, one of the grandmothers, is part of my family. My mother's her first cousin. I ask her, have you been able to speak with her? She says she's hopeful that he will be returned. On the street, a man who noticed my microphone and headphones stopped to give a comment.
¿Cómo se llama usted?
Damián Gómez.
My name is Damián Gómez, he says.
Que debe regresar lo más pronto posible.
He says Elian should be returned as soon as possible.
Que se debe darle conclusión a...
He said this matter must be concluded because it could lead to something serious, like an armed confrontation, a war.
Que se convierta en una cosa armada, una guerra. Ese es el problema que hemos tanto tratado de buscar de guerreros.
¿Y por qué cree que los norteamericanos y los I ask why it is that people that are doing this? In the U.S. He says it's all being politicized, both here and there. They've seized this as a political opportunity. But if his mother was alive, she could decide for him, but she's dead. I ask him, people in Miami say that Elian would be better off there. He would have a better life, because life is, that he would get more material things in Miami.
Sí, allí hay muchas cosas que aquí no hay. Y es verdad que...
Yes, he says it's true that it's different there and it's better, maybe a little different and better, but the decision should not be based on whether one system is better than another system. It's between him and his father. The rest is politics, should not be brought into it. I ask him how children live there in Cárdenas. He says, children have normal lives, they're free, they walk on the streets. But of course the government has exaggerated things and says things that are not so true. For instance, that there is nothing, that the schools are stocked with everything, including TV sets. That's not true. I have two children. Nine of them have TV sets in their schools. I buy them their books and I buy them their pens and their tablets. And that can't be like this. They have to say the truth. For instance, now they've restored the school, entire school of Elian's. They have paved the roads in Cárdenas, or at least some roads. And I think it's probably due to all the journalists that have stopped by in Cárdenas.
Digo también que eso yo llevo 4 años viviendo aquí en Cárdenas, nunca había visto afectar la calle.
He also said he's been there 4 years in Cárdenas, never seen roads paved the way they have been in the last few months. He says, I've commented this with friends of mine and who've been here a long time and they've never seen such progress before in Cárdenas. But of course, one block away from Elian's house, the road is not as paved and they didn't put the lights up. Yes, it's true that there are schools and medicine here is free and it's pretty okay, but they shouldn't exaggerate reality. They should stick to reality. I then walked over to Elian's school, the Instituto Presbiteriano La Progresiva, a freshly painted pastel pink building a few blocks from the main square. I arrived as the children were being let out of school, streams of uniformed kids with red scarves tied around their necks. They also had plenty to say about Elian.
Él debe regresar a la patria, porque esta es su patria.
One child says he should come back, this is his homeland.
Si él no regresa, nosotros vamos a seguir la lucha por él.
And if he doesn't come back, we'll fight for him.
¿Y de qué grado eres?
Tercero C.
¿Y conoces
she says a she's from the third grade, 8 years old.
No, no conozco, pero sé que está
I ask her if she knows Elian, and she says no.
¿Y tú cómo te llamas?
But I know that he's
Cada
in my
hueca.
¿Y qué opinas de Elian?
Que él tiene que venir.
He must come, he says another
vas?
Child.
¿A qué grado vas? ¿Cuántos años tienes?
Tercero C.
He goes to third C, which would be in Elian's grade.
¿Querías ir a Estados Unidos a por él?
I ask him if he'd like to go to the U.S.
Bueno,
to get
Elian. Yo quiero ir, pero a mí no me dejaron.
He says, I'd love to go, but they wouldn't let me. The school teacher wouldn't
pero
let
crees
me.
Que él tendría que estar aquí con vosotros, ¿no?
I ask him, you think
sí.
He should be here with
¿cuántos
you?
¿Cuántos años tiene?
He says, yes.
Ocho años.
I'm 8 years
ocho
old,
años.
He says.
Sí.
¿Conoces a Elian?
I ask him if he knows
si
Elian,
pudieras
and he
hablar
says
con él,
yes.
¿Qué le dirías ahora?
I ask him if he could que, speak with Elian, what would he say to him? He says,
gracias.
To come here. He should come here.
¿Y tú cómo te llamas?
Another child approaches. She's 8 years
ajá.
old.
¿Y qué opinas del caso de Elian?
I ask her what she thinks of Elian. And she says, Elian must return to Cuba.
Porque su maestra ya me la
I ask why, and she says, the whole family is waiting here
su
in
familia,
Cuba.
¿No?
Sí.
¿Tú conoces a Elian?
Yo no,
I ask her if she knows
yo,
Elian. She says she's new at the school this year, so she doesn't know him.
¿Tienen un mensaje para Elian?
I ask her if she has a message for Elian.
Sí.
This is another
¿cuál
girl.
Es tu mensaje, Elian?
Que vuelva pronto.
Another girl who says he must
que
return soon.
Van a ir a visitarle unos amiguitos.
Some of his little friends are coming to see him,
para
she
que,
says.
Bueno, los que van a ir van a ser los más allegados.
Those who are going, the closest
¿qué
friends.
¿Qué quieres decir a Elian? Si pudieras hablar con él, ¿qué le dirías?
What would you tell Elian? She says, everything that he needs, that he can count on me. I was his friend. And that was the end of my trip to Cárdenas.
Well, that was a really lovely sound portrait, and I thank you very much, Maria, for that.
Well, thank you very much.
As you return now to the United States and you see the controversy continuing, what are your thoughts? Is there now, I guess, battling over bringing the whole delegation, which will include a number of his school friends, to bring him up to Washington in case Elian has to stay in the United States for a little while? What's the rationale?
Well, there are many different theories, but the one that is presented by the Cuban government, and which has been talked about a tremendous amount, is that Elian was uprooted from his community very sharply and reintroduced somewhere that is very unfamiliar to him. In the midst of this, he's suffering from terrible trauma. And what they're hoping to do, they say, is by having him be surrounded once again with familiar sounds, with familiar people, to begin to have him begin to deal with his pain and with his trauma of losing his mother.
Are parents of these school children afraid their kids will be taken too if they come to the United States?
No, I think that they feel very empowered, and some of them were interviewed on the radio. As a matter of fact, as I was driving to Cárdenas, we heard quite a few interviews of the parents and the kids. The kids, who have been chosen to be on the delegation, were saying things like, I'm not afraid of U.S. imperialism. And the parents were very supportive, and they said, I would go, I will let my child go. Of course, there's another theory, some people are saying, that this is sort of to help the father cope with tremendous pressure to stay here and defect. A lot of money's been offered to him. So there are many theories floating around.
Well, Maria Carrion, thank you, and I'm glad to have you back. Maria Carrion is our senior producer at Democracy Now! The program was also produced by David Love and Deepa Fernandez. Errol Maitland is our technical director. He is still hospitalized in the coronary care unit in Brooklyn, New York, for covering a police attack on a funeral procession. Matthew Finch is our engineer. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening.